Hey everybody, Bina 007 here with a quick spoiler warning. This episode contains spoiler for The Winds of Winter throughout, not just in the after show. So apologies if you don't want to be spoiled, you just can't listen.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Great Linear Song of Ice and Fire reread from Vassals of Kingsgrave. This is the third and final part of the feast wrap-up that we're doing here, covering kind of the two final major POVs that we haven't so far, and that's Brienne and as well as the Greyjoys as a whole. Brienne is kind of one we've been ignoring for the past few. Oh, and Sam, I guess, yeah, a little bit. We did talk about him a little bit with Arya, but we can at least bring up the final chapter that we did not cover in Old Town. And joining me today are Michael.
Hey, what's up? Carl Wadeggi on the forums.
Noah.
Hey, Pops88 on the forums.
Wilson.
Hi, Wilson, Wandering Prophet on the forums.
And Bina.
Hey, everyone. Bina 007 here.
So, yeah, we've been kind of dancing around Brienne for the first two parts and have not gotten a chance to really deep dive into that. And there's some much needed conversation we need to have here, as she's kind of one of the, you know, in accordance with what we brought up previously, she's kind of one of the highlights of this novel, despite kind of the slow start of her first couple chapters. There's a lot of big moments that happen to her in this, and her journey is a big driving thematic presence throughout the book, as she kind of sees kind of the destruction of the Riverlands, and we get a lot of that anti-war stuff that George peppered into this novel. And I really enjoy kind of her mission around there, as well as meeting a lot of interesting characters and kind of developing this half-assed fellowship to try and find Sansa and Arya. And you know, we get some good stuff with she meets Randall Tarly. We have Nimble Dick Crabbe, get a glimpse of the Mad Mouse. We have the fight with Shagwell and the other two. Gets Hild Hunt and Pod are two pretty fun companions. We get the all-important Broken Man speech from Septon Maribald, as well as a chance encounter with a gravedigger and the lead brother, who gives us a nice little history of the Battle of the Trident. And then finally ending with the confrontation with the Brotherhood and Rorge and Biter. There's sneakily a lot that happens to her, even though it kind of seems like aimless meandering of her story. And in retrospect, it's a real highlight of the novel for me. So what are you guys' thoughts?
I don't want to drag down the tone, because I really like Brienne's chapters, particularly the later ones. But I also think that this is where the rot began, in terms of George expanding the world building as a substitute for the plot development. And I feel that this is a form of procrastination that has expanded into The Princess and the Queen, The World of Ice and Fire, Fire and Blood, all these things that George has been writing to avoid. Oh, and Dance with Dragons, of course. To avoid progressing the plot forward. But yeah, I do find Brienne's chapters very enjoyable, particularly on a second reread, but I feel like that's the elephant in the room.
Yeah, no, I definitely understand. This is kind of my current opinion that has changed over time. You know, it was certainly somewhat of a slog to get through kind of the first half of that in my first read of Feast back in the day. It's just something that has changed over time, where I just have a deeper interest in it now than I did back then.
I think I'm less tolerant than you, Matt. I'm very much where Michael is, that I found it frustrating on my first read through. And that coming back to it as a reread, there are certainly some POVs that I've become more tolerant of or enjoyed more, but this has not been one of them. And I certainly feel we could have had a compilation chapter and then the final chapter in Feast. And I completely agree with what Michael said about this being the start of the rod, of the world building that just needed to be taken out. I mean, it's interesting as far as world building goes, and he writes better world building than most, but it just absolutely, I think, contributes to why so many people have an issue with this book.
Well, so I don't know. I guess you guys have read this Brienne's chapters or Feast like more than two, three, four times. I think I'm on six, as of now. And I mean, I came late to the game. I came to the books after the show. And so the expansion that you speak of, like when Brienne goes to the Quiet Island, when she meets all these other characters like Lord Tarly and so forth, for me, that's exciting because this story I found is growing. And you learn more about Westeros and culture and what it means for certain people living in that world, like Brienne, who is, you know, caught between what's expected of her, what she wants to do, her duty, her desires. I really enjoyed learning that only because it's a new character in this world. That's not adding to the plot. I agree. Like her quest, if you look at her quest, alongside, I think Matt, you're the one who asked if, Feast and Dance were one novel running, all the chapters running alongside each other, would it be a different story? It would, with Brienne, because she's looking for these two girls and we know where they are. We know what they're doing. And so we know that, you know, she's not going to find them and all her leads are, you know, dead ends. But when you're reading Feast by itself and you don't know what's happening to Arya or Sansa at that point, it's a bit, you know, exciting to think, oh, she might be onto something or she might be advancing the plot. So that's how I felt while I was reading it. And even on the rereads, I guess I'm reliving that excitement when I, at first I read it and learned about all these other places and all these other people. So that's how I felt.
I actually think that is kind of a major issue with reading Feast with these chapters is that, I mean, yeah, maybe not for the first couple, but, you know, as we get Arya and Sansa chapters in this book, we essentially know that her mission is not going to succeed from the very start of the chapters. And so I think that really adds to kind of the painful feeling of just get on with it already, as she's kind of wandering around trying to locate people in the wrong place, and that we know that it's not going to succeed. And so I think, you know, similar to kind of some of Danny and John's chapters in Dance, where, you know, we can just see them making the wrong decisions over and over again. That's a great point.
And I'd never thought of it like that before. But it's almost like George has set up the Brienne POV to fail, because Brienne is being set up to fail. And that is inherently frustrating. So therefore, do you think he made the wrong writing choice?
I feel like there were a couple of ways you could make this less so much of a failure montage. Maybe if Brienne is not asking, have you seen my sister, every paragraph, or just if maybe the focus of each chapter is a little more on, say, the confrontation with Randall Tarly, the confrontation with the Brotherhood. I just feel that there might be some better ways to have written these chapters.
Yeah, I think what may have made it better is the target of her investigation, where if she kind of found out, you know, early on the general direction of where Arya and Sansa went, and then started, and then basically, you know, tried to kind of work backwards and target some other individuals. Basically, what I'm getting at is that, you know, instead of just simply hunting down Arya and Sansa, like partway through, she decides to try and, you know, proactively like hunt down the Brotherhood or the Hound or other like leads in that. So it would seem more, it would seem like her confrontations are more proactive on her part rather than just pure happenstance, maybe.
Completely.
Like she's getting somewhere, yeah.
Yeah, and like also she just at least taking, has a taking direction.
Taking her own fate into her hands. I mean, this is a woman who, we meet her blindly loyally following Renly, then she sort of blindly loyally follows Kat, and now she's blindly loyally following Jaime. And maybe there's a meta point there about knights and people who take orders. But it would be lovely to see this woman who has so much integrity and so much self-discipline acting under her own volition and crafting her own future. And making real macro choices about her life. And we haven't had that yet. Do you guys think we are going to have that in the next book, or do you think she won't last long?
We were discussing this in a recent, I think, the final Feast chapter recap, and that we feel that both Brienne and Jaime, they've got a long, not a long while, but they have more to go than just what's coming up in their imminent future. I don't see either dying immediately. So particularly Brienne has, she's got some trajectory.
Yeah, I'm fairly confident they'll make it to Dream.
It seems like being loyal, blindly loyal to people is either her Achilles heel or her pitfall. I don't know how to describe it, but I think it defines her, because as we follow her through and she's having these flashbacks to her father and her trainer, her father attempting to marry her off to people, her refusing to do that and deciding she wants to be a knight. Maybe that is her, I don't know. That's her way of asserting herself, like her blindly following or pledging herself to a cause, even though, you know, it's futile. But doing that is her defining herself. It just seems like having her go through the Riverlands or hunting people down doesn't really resonate with her need to be, to fulfill some sort of, I don't know, purpose. And Renly gave her that purpose because he was nice to her. She's like, okay, I'll follow this guy. He's not just nice, but he's the first person to be kind to me who's not my father, you know? And Kat was the opportunity to swear to something bigger than herself. That's how I felt about Brienne. And maybe that will end up dooming her, because if you think about it, that's what she's about. Her trying to, going on a quest that doesn't really have, a strong meaning, like looking for Kat's children or serving Renly. This doesn't seem like her. And so I don't know. Maybe George did that and has brought her back to Kat to kind of end that arc. I don't know. That's just a question.
I think that's a very valid point, that this is so intrinsic to her personality that her mission, she is her mission. Character is fate, in a Thomas Hardy, that was always his thing, wasn't it, with Far From the Madding Crowd and all his novels, that character is fate.
Yeah.
And she is so set in her character. And in a way that's good, right? Because it's a contrast. George writes characters that go on these great redemptive change arcs like Theon. But you start off with an essentially good woman like Brienne, and maybe that's her triumph, to see so much darkness and so much meanness and not to change. And maybe we should accept that. And to still be on mission when so many people leave or are treacherous or whatever.
Indeed, even up to the end. I mean, I'm not rushing Brienne, but I recently just read through it again, and she is at the end when they have her, when Kat has her, and even up until they put the noose around her neck, she's thinking, I will not betray my quest. I will not turn again. It's just very, kind of sad. But then at the end, and this is a question, reading the book, it says she screamed a word. Can anyone guess what that word is, or is it something that people know already? Because I've been trying to think about it. One word, not like, oh, I'll do it. That's three words.
It's the sword name, right? I mean,
I think George has confirmed this. Yeah, it was sword. Doesn't that blow your mind, Wilson?
It does. I don't know what to make of that. Like the sword's name, or just sword?
Just sword, because yeah, before that she's given Lady Stoneheart gives her the choice of the noose or the sword, as in to go hunt down Jaime.
Oh, okay. I'm thank you. I'm resolved now.
And therefore you guys believe that in the Jaime chapter, it is genuinely Brienne who comes and finds him. When he's at the siege with Edmure. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that's something I think, yeah, you brought up in the reread that we kind of glossed over. Yeah, I never really considered that theory that it wasn't Brienne before.
That theory is definitely the product of waiting this long for wins. I'm not saying it's a credible theory.
Yeah, no, I understand. Put it on par with the Quentin is alive theory.
Oh, bullshit. Quentin is alive. We went for dinner on Friday night, because White Raven's staying with me at the moment. So Mr. and Mrs. White Raven, Mr. and Mrs. Aranese, and Teddard and I were having like this literally serious discussion in the pub car park as we were leaving, saying, we really do genuinely think Quentin is going to show up. So I will defend that tinfoil until it's proven otherwise.
Until it's yes.
Indeed. Until I see a chain of evidence and a charred body, motherfuckers.
But so what about Loras? We can't have like two people that are just badly burnt coming back from the dead.
To your guys' point about Brienne becoming darker, I read a weird theory about her the other day, that George, when he was still planning the 5-year gap, that he was going to make Brienne into a pretty Meris, you know, from Quentin's storyline as part of the Windblown. So, like, she'd go through all this and fail effectively on her quest. And I guess this was before Stoneheart was in his thinking as well, and go to Essos and become a sellsword, and then eventually join up, I guess, with Quentin and Daenerys and whatever he had planned there.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember hearing this. Yeah, and until I hear otherwise, I think it seems a valid idea, or like a drafted idea. I do prefer what we got now. I would not be happy if she became Pretty Meris.
Yeah.
For many reasons. But I do like that George just included Pretty Meris as sort of like another character now that is a timeline diverged Brienne.
Parallel universe.
Yeah. I was going to ask, because I remember someone said, or maybe it was George, that, you know, he's looking for the person in the room who can give you the perspective that will kind of advance the story. And Brienne seems like a diversion from the main plots, like King's Landing and Daenerys and such. But maybe her quest gives us a view on what the war has done to the main part of Westeros. I keep thinking in my head that these bigger lands, like, you know, Maidenpool and like the where Harrenhal is, that area, I keep thinking they'll play a major role in some kind of big battle coming up in King's Landing. So knowing what these people, where they're situated and what's happening might be relevant later on. Or maybe not. Maybe this is just a segue that, you know, won't lead anywhere, but it's interesting to kind of guess and hope.
I do think that the desolation of the Riverlands and the way it affects the small folk is like an interesting outlet. It's something like I think is a good idea to explore. I would just say maybe we don't need to see so much of it. And when you go look at Arya in the Storm of Swords, the way her chapters would also deal with the small folk and what their role was in this war, that was merging sort of the plight of the small folk with plot advancement.
I agree that not to segue, I'm sorry, but that the Arya chapters that you just referred to really hit me. I mean, not vividly, but I remember the chapter where this young little girl joins them, and then during when they get caught up with Marbran, who attacks them, I think the girl runs off. Until this day, I wonder what happened to that child, and it bothers me in the back of my mind that George hasn't resolved that. Like, is she? Is she the girl at the inn? I don't know. But this little child ran off, and now only God knows she's probably in a ditch somewhere. That's just my segue, I guess, my problem.
Yeah. So, 2 points on kind of the previous stuff. I think, yeah, when comparing kind of the Brienne and Arya chapters, another issue with Brienne is how little kind of area she covers overall, you know, in the terms of an entire book. I think that's another thing he could have sped up with having kind of a larger interval in terms of travel time between her various chapters that may have sped things along a little bit. And then I think this is going way back to the conversation of kind of picking her place in the world and attaching herself to other people to follow, which I think is a valid way to write a character. There are certainly other characters I've read that are interesting to kind of do similar things. But I think in terms of her specifically, one thing at least that I'm, you know, looking for is in these kind of last couple books is for her to not pick a cause based on someone else, but pick a cause for herself that she wants to fight for, and that she chooses to kind of go all out for, and if she were to die, to die for, rather than dying at the hands of following someone else's quest.
I agree. I think that could be so powerful. This woman of complete integrity fighting for something she truly personally, not that she doesn't care about the other stuff, but something that's so meaningful to her personally would be amazing to read and to see. That's how I want to see her go out. I think she deserves that.
It would give some constructive evolution of her character, because I think we can all agree she's not going to change her morality. She'll always be the very pure and good character, but that would be, yeah, her motives would change. That'd be nice.
Yeah, for sure.
I keep hoping that she's kind of like the the equivalent of Barristan Selmy in Westeros, and that she will, you know, end up not regretting her loyalty and her goodness, but finding some kind of joy from all the suffering that she's had to endure serving other people, even when they're dead, you know? So, yeah, I do hope that that becomes her her end, as it were.
I see. I mean, this in her arc here, we get, and I think George's as well, we kind of get confirmation of her being related to Sir Duncan the Tall, right? Vaguely.
Yes.
I mean, and I think after the pace that was set by Storm, the chapters that weren't progressing the plot as rapidly as he'd done previously were always going to suffer. And I feel like if these chapters were maybe part of their own story, they might hold more sway. You know, because it is, she, in her personal arc, she does, you know, confront a lot of things that she, you know, like the, she confronts the Brave Companions, she goes through a lot of issues with trusting men, not just, you know, with Podrick, or, but Dick Crabbe and Heil Hunt, and it, there's a lot to her story in this, and I feel like she just suffers from, you know, we've just had some of the biggest players in the game die, and now we're following some bloke in a pub down a rabbit hole that we know, you know, she's looking for Sansa at the Whispers, and we know, you know, as you discussed earlier, that that is so far from where she is. But if it was kind of more of like a maybe a Duncan Egg kind of novella story, we might think of it differently.
Or just a contracted version with some of the earlier chapters removed. I really do feel like there was a way to make these chapters work in a way that is interesting and satisfying. Because, yeah, a lot happens in these chapters.
Yeah. So is that then a failure of editing? Of George either not having a good editor or not responding to their advice? Because in the early books like Game of Thrones, you'll get three Dany chapters set wide-spaced with a lot that occurs. Mm. And I feel that's... And they're very long chapters relative to the others. And I think that would have worked well for Brienne. I'd love to know the inside story of how the books... In general, how books get constructed. But the editing process. Because it feels that this was an obvious place for that to have occurred.
It's a shame. It's a shame because it affects people's perception of it. And you know, and ultimately it does end with a pretty badass cliffhanger with her and Stoneheart after fighting Rorge and Biter. And, you know, there is some great moments and great scenes in there.
Mm, and it has real consequence. I mean, as POVs go, what happens to Brienne and where she ends up and what happens next are deeply important for these books. And I think not only do they affect people's perceptions of Feast, I think they actually affect people's perception of Brienne. So because, and I've never thought about it today till today, that I think I had this prejudice that she was somehow dumb. Like, have you seen my sister? Like, I've done that stupid voice on this podcast. And it's because, like you said, I know that she's on a fool's errand and that she's looking in completely the wrong place. And that's not fair for me to read that back onto this poor character, but I do. And I wonder how many people have subconsciously had their opinion of Brienne fall based on the rambling nature of the travels in this book.
Thick as a castle wall.
Yeah, I agree. Because, like, in A Storm of Swords, we see at the tavern, she's able to read that the innkeeper is, like, not their friend. And he's trying to lead them onto, like, a booby-trapped trail. So, like, she is not an idiot.
Well, it's the same as Dunk. You know, people call him stupid and stuff, but he is quite perceptive. And just like Brienne, they have an intuition that is different from other characters, which may make us look down because they're not the kind of cunning that, say, Tyrion or Cersei are. But they're within their own right, not, you know, have a level of intelligence that sees them through the story.
It really would be a shame to lose someone like Brienne on a meaningless quest or some kind of, I don't know, inconsequential death. Because you think about it, someone like her who, or like Dunk, who, you know, they're very loyal and they are not stupid, like you say. They're not, you know, clunking around, but they are devoted to whoever it is they serve. That's a great asset to any of the big kingdoms. Imagine if she was present with, you know, let's say Dany. I know their stories are not crossed, or with, you know, with, I'm thinking about, you know, the Wall, or even King's Landing, you know, if she were there with Jaime. Someone like that, with that kind of character, can influence things in a big way. So, yeah, I do hope she does not end up just, like, caught up in some kind of you know, skirmish and dies for no reason.
You see, I don't think we're going to lose her in the way that you describe, and I think that would be harsh, like to some pointless, petty death. But I almost feel like I lost her in this book to a kind of trivial and petty road trip that ultimately meant nothing. So I don't think George is going to do her wrong in the end, or in the next book even. But I kind of feel that for half a book, he a little bit did her wrong as a character.
Okay. That's it's a shame we don't get any part of her in a dance, because it is truly the cliffhanger for her character to know what happens next.
Yeah, and that's why we didn't get it, because it's going to take several chapters to resolve, probably, and there just wasn't enough space for it.
Yeah, it's a shame. He's done such great work getting her to this point, and it does feel like kind of stuck in a pothole. I was just thinking about it, and she's probably had the toughest in terms of female warriors in the story, or females trying in Westeros trying to kind of break that male, you know, well, in terms of maybe knighthood or being a warrior. She's come from the Reach, and as far as I'm aware, there are no other female warriors from the Reach. I mean, if you think in Dorne, you have obviously a completely different culture, but just off the top of my head, you have a Barra Sand. You go to the Iron Islands, and Asha Greyjoy is hugely respected. You know, in the north, you have the Mormonts, Mage and Daisy, and well, all of Mage's daughters. You know, I think she's come so far through almost impossible odds to become someone that we love and someone that we all really revere, and she can really hold her own in this portion of the story.
You know, the comparisons you just made were very interesting. All the people you described, they're kind of like apart from the mainland of Westeros, right? Like the Reach, not the Reach, sorry, Dorne, the Iron Islands, the North. These ones are, their cultures are very different from the, you know, mainland kind of idea of men and women. Yeah, it's interesting. And she's the only one truly on mainland who is doing her thing the way she's doing it. So I guess that speaks to culture in mainland Westeros. Is that a thing? Or have I coined
maybe. Maybe. I mean, because even, I mean, in the who's the closest there is, and kind of Cersei, who's, I mean, we've spoken about that at great length already, but making a real mess of it.
Yes,
when
indeed.
She's got her moment. It would be great to see Brienne say like best Randall Tarly at some point or something, just to put him down a peg or two, or I don't know.
I will admit, and I'll say, I enjoyed thoroughly when she met Roge and the other person at the Smuggler's Cove. Yeah, that was
you mean Shagwell and Shagwell, the Brave Companions. Yeah.
Yes, not the Biter. She handled the two of them by herself. Mm. That was sweet to read and listen to. And she would have, knowing that she had no chance against Biter and seven, you know, of those outlaws, she still went out there and did her thing. So I think the level of respect you get for her, because, you know, it's life and death. And she marches in there afraid, but still, you know, courageous and does her thing. I really did enjoy it.
I mean, yeah, that is the line of her POV chapters, with no chance and no choice. That's pretty much kind of the one we all remember her character by.
Yeah, indeed.
Definitely. So, so right at the end, we get Brienne meets up with Gendry. He's become a knight by that point, right? He's Sir Gendry. And do you think...
Is he?
I think he is knighted. There's like Sir Gendry of the Hollow Hill.
I mean, I didn't know they did that in the Brotherhood.
Well, I think maybe... Must have been Beric. I don't know if there are any other knights in there.
I mean, yeah. I don't think he met them before Beric died.
Gendry.
When he's hammering his sword, he says, "I'm a knight." Is that just him boasting, or do you think someone actually dubbed him as a knight?
Yeah, certainly possible. It's just not something they usually, discuss. You know, in the chapters we've seen from the Brotherhood. But,
I didn't
know.
Think that was sort of official. I thought it was more, I have a certain standing within the Brotherhood. Like, okay. I don't know, but I could be wrong. It never occurred to me that he was actually like dubbed a knight by someone.
Yeah, I didn't remember that line.
Oh, maybe I'm dreaming. I could have sworn he was. Oh, well, maybe he will be in the next books. Maybe I can see the future, you guys. What do you think? What do you think his role will be in future stories? Would you think his role in Game and Clash were what all he had to bring? Do you think he'll meet up with Arya later? You think he'll help Brienne potentially in her trial?
I mean, yeah, like, I don't know exactly. I'm sure he'll continue to have a minor role, and obviously his skills as a blacksmith are useful. And I don't think he'll get pulled down with the Brotherhood should they inevitably be kind of defeated here, or at least part of the Stoneheart, part of their group kind of excised. But there's a lot of possibilities for him. I don't have a clear picture, and nor have I put a lot of thought into it as to where he'll end up.
Yeah, I have no, I don't have an inkling as to what the future holds for him. I was hoping he would like be just like big evidence that Cersei's kids are incestuous, because that seems to be the role that he was meant to play in Game in the first book. But I don't think that's a moot point now. No one cares that Robert's children are illegitimate now, I think. But I don't know.
No. Well, I mean, he was knighted. I just found it now. In Storm of Swords, he was knighted by Beric in the Hollow Hill.
Oh, okay, cool.
He's still got to learn about his parentage, I think. He's got to find out he's a king's bastard, and God knows what the implications of that will be. But perhaps it'll make officially? Him... No. I'm just looking at the wiki now, and it says he's remains ignorant of his heritage. Not sure what that could do. I don't see him getting involved with Fagon, considering Fagon would believe Gendry's dad killed his dad, so that's probably a no-go. But perhaps he'll come to Sansa's aid because of he knows Arya? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if his parentage matters that much anymore.
Maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe he'll just be rowing a boat for the rest of...
I was about to say, but like, besides his own... His parentage doesn't matter in the larger context, I think, of the story. You know, it would matter to his, you know, personal journey. So that would be the only real thing. It'd be fun to see kind of the big three of Robert's bastards kind of meet up at some point in the story with him, Edric, and Maya Stone. But I'm sure that's just wishful thinking on my part.
Of all the characters that George has to do a reunion for, I think that's quite far down his list.
Yeah, that's at the very bottom.
Well, I hope it is anyway.
All right, should we move on to the Greyjoys here?
Yes, woo! I think so.
Overall, the Greyjoy plotline was one that I was not, you know, that's another one I was not as interested in, but has grown on me over time, and it's mainly due to Asha being what I consider kind of the central POV for the Greyjoys. Yeah, I view it similar to the Dorne chapters in this book, where there's one particular character that I see as kind of the main POV we get out of that region, and Asha is the Arianne, and then the other two are there for story related reasons and not really for personal journey related reasons. The Dampier chapters were another one. I just considered him a worthless POV until we got the Winds preview. But, you know, it's still the same thing as his purpose is just to be, to have eyes on Euron. And so that alone makes his POVs, you know, fascinating. But I don't really care as much about his personal journey, although he definitely deserves our sympathy as he's one of the most abused characters in the story. And, you know, Victarion for me is, I enjoy his chapters in terms of kind of amusing entertainment, and you know, he's good for some action bits, as well as, you know, his inevitable death I'm sure will be entertaining, but you know, there's not going to really be a big personal story I feel like he's going to go through in the end, whereas Asha has, you know, truly like interesting character development storyline that we've been following, and I'm excited to see more of.
I feel like, Aeron and Victarion both their chapters have value once you, I don't know, realize what's going on. Like once you realize that Aeron has been horribly abused and his entire personality, which is very off-putting, is basically his defense mechanism to this, he becomes a lot more interesting. And similarly with Victarion, once you realize he's a fucking idiot and his chapters have this like black comedy tone to them, I think they are quite entertaining. But I will say the Iron Island characters in general, they suffer from just being so foreign and different. Introducing us to all three of these characters, which have only really featured in Theon's POV chapters so far, can be... It has the Dawn problem as well of introducing all these new different characters that are strangers.
Yeah, however, I think the difference is that because of what an interesting character Oberyn was in Storm, more readers, including myself, were always excited to see more of Dorne, whereas we didn't really care as much about the Iron Islands, and that has to do with their culture, you know, where Dorne is, you know, has a less misogynistic culture and more progressive views than the rest of Westeros, where the Iron Islands are just like the epitome of shit. And so yeah, so that's kind of like a reason, although the Kingsmoot chapter is definitely a highlight of East.
The epitome of shit. I'm going to quote you on that whenever I use it in my class, okay?
Yeah.
I think we have a podcast title, Bina.
Yeah, I think so. It's some your shit. So, question, and my memory doesn't always work like I like, but Theon is the only Greyjoy we know in game and in the first three books, right? We meet Asha in this book, correct or no?
Clash.
Oh, Clash. So we get her POV, or do we... Do we get
no.
meeting her? Okay.
No, but we see quite a bit of her when he's in the Iron Islands.
But her POV comes up in this book,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So if I'm correct, we start with the damp hair, the prophet, and then we go on to Asha and then Victarion, right? When we're learning, that's the order the Greyjoys come in. If that's the case, I'm guessing... Go ahead.
Well, and Victarion might be officially introduced before Asha. I don't remember the exact order, and I don't know who provides the POV for the Kingsmoot, because it's not Asha.
It's Aeron.
It is Aeron.
Yeah, I think the order is Aeron, Asha, Victarion, because we see Victarion like the night before the Kingsmoot. That's when he has his first chapter, I believe.
Gotcha.
Okay, awesome. To your point about expanding the book as opposed to the plot, I think the Greyjoys, because a ton of history. I mean, there's some conversations that Asha is having with the Rita, and they're just going on about history over and over. And it makes me think that the Greyjoys are an ornament to, oh no, I'm sorry, that's not the right word. Their being part of the story just shows how big this world is and the miles of history they have, as opposed to actually driving the plot. Almost it seems like their main purpose is to ferry ferry Daenerys from Essos back here, and rather than just showing up and saying, hey, here we are, the reader needs to know why, you know, there's a fleet going her way. And so I think maybe from that, this was written because, like you say, Asha is the complex one besides Theon. Asha is the one with some kind of conflicting motive. You know, she has to be tough, but she also knows that the Iron Islands won't survive if they go to war, and she wants to be queen, but then, you know, she's not willing to just blindly do what her captain wants. So I don't know. I do think that of the three of them, Asha might be the one to last longer. If so, then maybe she has a bigger role to play for the entire plot moving forward. Otherwise, like you say, I have nothing left for, no love for the Iron Islands, truly. Zero.
When you look at the impact that Euron has had on the story, and that he's becoming this huge force of gravity in the Reach, I would say that they're not just on peripheral characters, and that they are definitely going to have a large impact on the central plot. It's just that we haven't seen so much of it as of yet, as of the end of Feast. Again, this is Dance. Ash's dealings with in the North is also going to be have a large impact. But yeah, right at this point, they're just being introduced in a similar manner to Dawn, where they haven't had a huge impact on the plot yet.
Yeah, and that, and I think that's the key as to perhaps some people's, if you had a negative opinion of the Greyjoy chapters in this book, it's mainly because we didn't have the context as to how important and impactful they were going to be to the plot while reading this novel. And it's not really until later on that we realize how important they are and that these chapters have more meaning to them than we originally thought. And that's probably, why I didn't enjoy them as much through my first read through.
A big mistake was waiting so long to what was revealed in the Winds of Winter preview chapter. But to be fair to him, I believe some con somewhere, don't quote me on it exactly, but he offered the choice between, I think it was an Ariane and an Aeron chapter at a con many, many years ago, one of the first spoiler chapters he revealed, and people obviously chose Ariane based on how fucking dull Aeron Dampere is. And if that had been revealed maybe a little bit sooner, we would have been like, oh, hang on a second, we should pay attention to these guys. We not just Asher, but Euron is a fucking force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, I do wonder why that really interesting Aeron chapter was not in A Feast for Crows, because I don't think it would have been out of place there. It might just be that George hadn't written it. Although it does, when you read that chapter, it does feel like it has been written for a while, because it's very polished, very smooth.
Even just like the Jaime chapter in Dance could have just been standalone, just, massive cliffhanger for the next book.
Yeah, I mean, it probably just had to deal with, it's still, that aspect of the story is still technically, for the last, the final act of the series, whereas he was kind of still, Feast Dance is still writing in part of the second act. So I think, in terms of narrative position, it would be something that you would include as like an epilogue to the Feast Dance storyline, in order to tease the next part. But just because of how much kind of the story got away from him, there was never really a good point to fit it in.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because like this chapter, which I'm going to talk about for a while, it spells out the abuse that Aeron has been through, whereas before it's just more implied. And I think that is very important in how you view Aeron and interpret him, and that's what makes him a lot more interesting. So I just feel that I would have liked it sooner.
Yeah, it's a shame.
Well, now, especially with, we're, the Greyjoy's end in Feast. We do see Victarion and Dance. But I guess the mainland, the Greyjoys that were affecting Westeros, is linked. They're already they're plundering the Reach. It is kind of relevant. They could have been included, and I don't think it would have been too out of place as sort of a finale.
Yeah.
A cliffhanger that I would have liked to have.
Yeah, I mean, you really could have put it as like an epilogue after Sam's chapter at the end of Feast. It probably would have worked pretty well.
Yeah.
Seeing as their plan to attack Old Town.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really did enjoy going to Asha, getting her perspective, because she was actually one of the characters that I had misunderstood the most. And this comes from just reading Theon's chapter without a critical eye and sort of taking his word as like truth, which is clearly not the case in A Clash of Kings. But I think Asha is actually one of my favorite characters. She's just a very interesting force of personality. And the way she sort of deals with these contradictions of her society and the way that she's been raised is, it's cool. I like her.
I would have been shouting her name at the King's Moot, put it that way.
I agree. It's hard to balance, strength and gentleness in one character. I think Asha does it properly, where she is strong in a society that really shuns any sign of weakness, but she's not stupid and she's not cruel, like when she has hostages, she cares that they live and So that's the kind of leader I think the Iron Islands could benefit from. But would they choose her? I don't think so. I always thought the Iron Islands were kind of the distraction of Westeros, you know, like they want to do their own thing. So let them go. You know, who cares? But now Euron has shown up and he wants to take over Westeros. And that's different for me. It's I always expect the Iron Islands to rebel and go away. And so their absence will be of consequence. But Euron has changed that, and maybe they will play a big role in, you know, massive conflict to come.
They're the ultimate wild card.
I would say the problem of the Iron Islands is actually the opposite, in that they're not letting them go on their way has always been the problem, is that they haven't been incorporated into Westeros. Just when you look at like their history and how they've been shunned, and this has caused them to fall back on their reaving time and time again. So I think that their future is to be incorporated further into Westeros, probably under Asha's rule.
Yeah, because they can't survive otherwise. Their way of life is not sustainable, and they can't support themselves without help because of their geographical situation and lack of resources. So yeah, that's really the only way to quote unquote, you know, fix them is to incorporate them into Westeros, you know, economically. And that's really the only way to kind of prevent the reavings and rebellions going forward.
And they wouldn't thank you for it, because that's such a part of their culture. You incorporate them and you die. They just become another bunch of rural peasants. It would be to annihilate their culture effectively.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, that's something we've talked about in the you know, one of the rereads, where, you know, I kind of theorized that their culture was specifically designed in order to kind of move along, you know, to encourage their style and way of life that they live now.
Something that Stephen Atwell pointed out in his really good Race for the Iron Throne series is that Braavos, which also features prominently in A Feast for Crows, it basically had the same beginnings and environment and resources that the Iron Islands have, but they have prospered, you know, as this excellent trade capital. As basically, I feel like it's George saying, "Hey, Iron Islands, you can, if you stop being terrible, you can make this work. You know, geography is not destiny."
But isn't the geography of Braavos better than those of the Iron Islands, insofar as it sits on major shipping lanes, which the Iron Islands don't?
Well, so does the Iron Islands in terms of its ability to connect the north, the Westerlands, and the Reach. Like, this is a lot of resources that could be moved around, and the Iron Islands have the ships to do it. So, like, okay, they don't have access to the shipping lanes of Essos, but
I feel that's where Braavos wins, because like Constantinople, Venice and Dubrovnik, the great city-states of old, it connects east to west. So the Iron Islands could become an intra-Westerosi trading hub, but the real money, the real juice, is connecting east to west, I feel.
Until we find out there's a huge continent.
That everyone's just been missing this entire time. It's hidden in the mist.
It's where Winds is.
Grey Havens.
Well, if you put Asha in charge, I think she will be able to make that argument. But the other people, they scorn people who buy things. You know, they hate people who pay the gold price. And it's rooted in their culture to be anti, you know, any kind of civilization. I don't know. They take, they don't sow. They're stronger, so, you know, they must rule. It's just a way of life that maybe does not gel well with the rest of Westeros, I don't think.
No, tiny, awful islands. You know, the people... It's in Theon's chapter when he first comes to the islands in Clash that the people toil in the mines. And even back in the day, it used to be slaves that toiled in the mines. And it's an awful way of life, you know, that they live. So no wonder why they're miserable and unhappy and want to kill everyone on the mainland. And they're jealous of the lovely green fields and stuff, maybe.
That's right, indeed.
Yeah, it's a place that should have never been settled in the first place.
It's true. Well, so they're Andals, right? They're Andals, the Iron Island folk. They're Andals. They're not First Men, right?
There is First Men. Like, it wasn't settled with the Andals. There were people living there beforehand.
Oh, I see. Yeah. When you hear the history of the Arryns, they were first men first, and then the Andals came, and there was war, and then they intermarried, and now they're Andals more, mostly. But with the Iron Islands, I don't know if they were the Iron Islands, like, with their own king and so first, and then the Andals came and supplanted them, like they did, or are they purely Andals who came and through strength became the Iron Islands, like with their driftwood crown? I don't know. All the history that we read about the Naga and the bones, and was that Andal history or is that First Men history?
What's Andal history?
That's pre-everything. Like, that stuff was there before the First Men. That stuff was there before the people that we know settled there. So yeah, there are hints of, like, more ancient civilization stuff there.
They're more fish people than they are Andal.
Yeah.
Okay, I just wonder, because the Andals are, they sound like adventurous people who can, you know, up and leave and change their entire lifestyle when it's necessary. But the Iron Islands just seem so, the Ironborn, they just seem so stubborn in their ways. And that's what's holding them back, I think. I don't know.
This isn't really relevant to Feast, but there is a lot of interesting stuff in the World of Ice and Fire about when the Andals came, and they're these great seafarers. So they did challenge the Iron Islanders, and then you have the establishment of these Hawkings, who, not whores, but spelled H-O-A-R-E, who were like Andal inspired, and they really didn't get along with the old way, and they would kill all these priests, and they were getting very close to integrating with Westeros, but it was not to be. So there's a lot of cultural back and forth that I at least find interesting in the Iron Islands.
It is a big book, and you learn plenty about different places, I think. I think when George Martin started the series, he just had a simple plan, but as he continued to go and go, it just grew. And now, you know, it's bigger than it was initially intended to be. But it's still very interesting. And not all of it is main story plot related, but I think maybe Feast does that, where, because there is a lot of history mentioned in Feast, even in Dorne, when Arianne is doing her thing, they start talking about the history of Westeros and the Iron, the Kingmaker, and all those things. So if Feast feels like a drag, maybe it's because, you know, we do deviate plenty from the plot and go on these historical journeys that hopefully in the end will add more to the to where the main story is going. Otherwise, it's just fun to learn more about this big world, indeed.
See, some of that is like plot relevant. Like when Arianne brings up the Kingmaker, she's making an analogy to her own position. So like, that's the world building I like, that's integrated with the plot. God, I've said this so many times, but yeah, the stuff that is just world building and world building alone, that belongs in the World of Ice and Fire.
Yes, it does.
No arguments from
me. For sure. We've certainly talked about this before, but yeah, there's a balance to it, you know, of having, you know, world building that's also relevant to the story we're reading, and George probably doesn't quite nail it in these two chapters. In these two books, even if there are some interesting points.
So question for you guys, and I know we'll wrap up with the Greyjoy soon, but we know that as a side to everything that's happening in Westeros, magic is coming back to the world. Daenerys has her her kids, and people are getting raised up from the dead and such. Do you think that the prophet in the Iron Islands, Aeron, right? Do you think that maybe this is relevant in some way? I don't know if that's why we have these POVs, if they will do something seriously magical, or if that's somehow relevant to the plot.
I think it's 100% relevant to Euron, not poor Aeron. This return of magic is definitely portending something fishy, as I've always said, with the Iron Islands.
God damn it.
Indeed. Well, I see Euron as you know, a thing apart. I'm still not convinced he's really Euron. I think he's something else, because he just seems so different, you know?
Engine.
Yeah, but
and Daria too, right?
Indeed, but I just feel like Aeron with the Kingsmoot and the I'm hoping they can conjure some kind of magic in this world. It'll make it interesting. Like we've seen magic from three different realms, like from Valeria, from the Red Priestess. We've seen Dany's magic. And the North, they have their own magic. So I thought maybe this will be a fourth, perhaps, potentially.
Yeah, I'd love to see some Krakens. That would be awesome.
Yes, that would be handy.
Yeah, certainly handy. Jesus.
I think for a certain there will be Krakens and all that tentacly glory in the future.
Indeed. We'll wait and see.
They've been brought up too much. So it's become Chekhov's Kraken at this point, where I would be disappointed if we don't see one. Yeah.
Do you think Aeron Greyjoy could be the one to kill Euron ultimately?
I would love it if it were true. It would feel like the Clegane bowl we all want and need.
I agree that similar to how Sansa and Littlefinger are tied together, I think it's a very, very high possibility that Aeron is involved in Euron's eventual downfall.
It would be great. I love a quote back in Clash, which is probably more relevant to Euron and Balon, but I'm paraphrasing, but it's once in a while Greyjoy died in the halls of Pyke, and only when his brother kills him, or something like that. And obviously that's in reference to Euron killing Balon, but that would be great if it came full circle and Aeron somehow managed to bring down Euron in the halls of Pyke.
God, that would be so cool.
That would be.
Do you think that's happening in TWOW, or do you think this Greyjoy plotline is going to continue into Dream?
I don't see how it could be resolved in just Winds of Winter. I think a confrontation with Daenerys is inevitable. I think this is definitely going into Dream. Euron is like a late game major villain.
Yeah, he's the third act villain. He's not going down until the very end.
Yeah.
Make huge distraction from the Long Night and the
Absolutely.
Others.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Or intertwined with the Long Night.
Yeah, probably connected.
I've always thought that Euron is...
He's up to some dark magics or something that just bring about the apocalypse or herald the apocalypse.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
He helps it along.
I certainly believe that Bloodraven has been twiddling in his mind.
100%.
Yes, another believer, yes.
I mean, yeah. Crow's Eye, how can you not?
So it's basically Euron and Bran and as his avatars on Earth.
Euron was a failed apprentice.
Yeah.
Before we wind down on Greyjoys, one of my all-time, if not the favourite, sub-character is Roderick Harlaw, the Reader, who I mean, he's certainly written to appeal to us readers, of course.
Yeah, I think the first time I met you in a pub in South London, I think about the fourth thing you said to me was about Roderick the Reader knowing shit. And I was like, this boy knows his stuff. I think it was like the fourth thing after telling me you were a gooner. But yeah.
My one redeeming quality.
And I was like, okay, now we can be friends.
Well, it's funny you mention that because I was about to probably spout out the same thing that I said to you back all those years ago. But so he's something I didn't know before looking into his history is he advised against Balon rebelling the first time round when Robert and Ned sat his ass down. Despite that, he still committed fully to the cause, and both of his sons died, I think, off Fair Isle, so Stannis would have been in command of that. So he preaches peace and he preaches the right things, but no one can question how committed he is and actually warlike and loyal in his own way. And he's obviously present and a part of Euron's army that marches on the Reach. And he's, I think, the only person who has had the balls enough to call Euron out when he's talking about sailing to Valyria, and he just like kind of shuts him down in front of all the captains. And my God, I love that man. He's great.
And Euron gets all butt hurt. I really like that.
Shut up, Roderick. Go read a book. But there's a great little line in there, and I'm sure maybe it's just something that was thrown in by George, but he allegedly has a copy of Marwyn's Book of Lost Books, which contains three pages of signs and portents, which is written by Danis the Dreamer, who's the little girl who told the Targaryen family to pack their shit up and get out of Valyria and move to Dragonstone. And my God knows what, if that's ever going to come up again, but I love that little sort of tidbit and that Marwyn has, Roderick has this. And he's aware of perhaps something that we're not yet.
He does come across like Marwyn and Maester Aemon of these upper tier characters who are aware of, you know, prophecy and the greater world at large. And just for that, I have to respect him.
Yeah.
I worry, like, people like that who know things, who could actually be of use, will either get shouted down by people like Euron and even Viterion, who is not, you know, wholly evil, but they just shun people who know things so much, or people who don't have a warlike, like, single-mindedness about the world. They just get shouted down. Or after you mentioned him standing up to the Crow's Eye, after reading that chapter, in my mind, Roderick is dead as we speak, because no one speaks to the Crow's Eye. In my mind, I've already said my farewells. We've had a ceremony and everything, because it's just like a death wish. But it will be tragic if someone like him is lost for no reason, because he does know stuff, and he'll be a great asset to like Asha if she becomes anyone of significance in the Iron Islands, you know?
I feel like they talk about who's his heir way too much for it not to for him not to die.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I know. Speaking of which, his one of those dudes is Harris Harlaw, who's got a Valyrian steel sword, which is 100% going to be taken by Euron. Like, I don't know why he hasn't done it already and found some pretext to get him killed. He's like the only knight on the Iron Islands, and he's a bit of a badass in his own right.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. I don't recall where he is at the moment. Is he sailing with Euron now, or
did he got made like a lord of one of the Shield Islands.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, that sword's going to be in Euron's hands. It's called Nightfall as well. So, yeah. I mean, that's got to be a Euron something with his magical intentions.
Yeah, it's an unruly personality. But your Dark Star wants that as well. Well, he didn't want Dawn so badly.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of Nightfall.
So I think we've given the Greyjoys a fair shake. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I don't have anything else.
No, me
neither.
Let's
do some Sam.
But see, if you want, I don't have much to.
I have nothing to say on Sam. Nothing on Sam.
Yeah, like he's mainly a character that I'm, you know, looking forward to in the future with his old town shenanigans.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that would be an excuse to kind of talk, following on from the Greyjoys, a little bit about old town.
Thinking about Sam, has he moved the plot, in your opinion, forward in Feast?
No.
You could argue that without this, this is Dance with Dragons, but without his advice, John ended up getting himself stabbed. Maybe he could have prevented that. But again, that's not Feast related.
We needed to get him to Old Town. And this is, and so, you know, this book was just him traveling there, you know, similar to what Tyrion does in Dance, where he needs to get to Daenerys.
And observe the stuff around him more than interacting with it.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly some interesting stuff with Aemon and him running into Arya. But beyond that, there's not much, you know, but like George does, you know, a fine job of keeping his chapters to a minimum so that they don't take up unnecessary space.
I get needing to have a point of view, and we learned, I think, a few things about Aemon's interaction with Rhaegar about the prophecy and things like that, which is cool. Besides liking Sam, I don't know if there was anything that was significant in him moving. Like, I think, was it Bina or Matt who mentioned that one of his chapters was completely identical to John's chapter later on in Dance, when, you know, he meets with him to talk about the others or whatnot. But we did learn about the switch, the baby, the switch in the babies, which was a bit of a surprise. when we learn that, Gilly's baby. Whether that will be of significance later, I don't know. Besides that, I'm just happy for Sam.
I'm not sure if it's important in terms of will that baby be important for a reason, but I think it was certainly important to establish that as a possibility before Fagon. Well, depending on where you stand on it, either believe that Varys did switch the babies or, you know, that is something that's possible.
Never really thought of that.
Switching shenanigans.
I mean, the main important reference from Sam's chapters is we get the major hint of who Bloodraven is, as when they do the reveal at the end of Bran's chapters, it's the thousand eyes and one reference that we get in Sam's chapters in this book. That was kind of the main connecting thread to figure that out.
And also how Bloodraven was sent to the wall. I think Aemon mentions that to Sam in one of these chapters as well.
Yeah, when Aemon escorted Bloodraven, right?
Yeah, they came up together. And that's also, you know, a reason of what we said in the previous sections of this cast is I think Bran's chapters would have worked fine being in this novel instead of Dance.
Yeah, at least a couple.
I foresee a confrontation between Sam and Randall Tarly, who was obviously set up in A Feast for Crows with Brienne's chapters. I think it's just, again, from a narrative or dramatic standpoint, those two characters have to come into conflict and stuff happens. So that'll be interesting in the future.
Definitely. Yeah, for sure. Definitely.
Yeah. For his personal journey, he needs to do that.
Do you think we will learn more of your Euron's assault on Old Town through Sam?
Oh, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
He's our POV into this, because I expect Old Town to be taken, and Sam will be living under Euron's occupation, whatever that entails.
Yes. So if that is so, would you think, and hopefully maybe this happens, that Euron, well, no, I'm overthinking now. I'm thinking, I'm hoping for a meeting between the Prophet and Sam, because, you know, those are two people who know some things. But whether that's of any consequence, I don't know. But it will be fun to watch or read about that, the invasion of Old Town, and what that means. Does that then mean that the Tyrells will come back and leave King's Landing, and therefore Cersei is exposed? I don't know. It's interesting, but Sam will give us the point of view for that, I guess.
We'll certainly get to see the Hightowers, who have played zero role in the book so far, except, what, Jorah's ex-wife? Aside from that.
Indeed.
And for a house that play in all of the prequels and a lot of the world books, there's such a huge house, you know, that don't get mentioned. And they're certainly not an afterthought in this story. But, I mean, there are a lot of what-ifs in this situation, because we effectively, at the end of Sam's arc in Feast, we turn up in Old Town, have a chapter, and then that's it. So there's a lot more that I'd love to see in Old Town. And a big bit of crackpot, which I kind of want, I feel is maybe one of the things we're closest to finding out, is that broken horn that Sam has, is that the horn of Jormund or not?
I don't think that's crackpot at all. I think that's 100% right.
Well, I mean, so it would be great to see that. I mean, I guess... Yeah, you know, I guess, Michael, you've definitely heard this one, but it's he climbs the high tower and blows the horn and the wall comes down. You know, like how the Night's Watch blow the horn for the coming of enemies.
It's something I'm very much dreading. I really do not want that to be the case, as that would be such a major example of extreme narrative convenience.
Yes.
Yes. That would be
But I think you've got to expect a couple of those as we move into the denouement now. He's got to bring people together. He's got to sort out certain narrative knots. And I wouldn't begrudge him one or two narrative conveniences, put it that way.
Yeah, I guess I'm more of a fan of there being an important magical artifact in the Hightower itself, rather than something being brought there at just the right time.
Yeah, that would be fair. I agree.
Yeah, I mean, what's his name? Lord Layton has been locked up there for years.
Yeah.
Yeah, according to the book. yeah, consulting spells and such.
Yeah, with his daughter called Melora Mad Maid, I believe, something like that.
Yes, yes, indeed.
But is that? I feel like that's going to be one of those where we actually meet her and she's completely sane and just has some abilities with magic and regular ideas in terms of the story.
Yeah, that's it's something we saw a lot of in Fire and Blood and the World Book, where it's just, you know, with women with historical and important women with like kind of natural magical abilities are just all always like labeled as insane, yeah, crazy, like burn, yeah, exactly. So you know, it's just one of those perspective things.
Yeah,
it's interesting with the high towers because like they're being built up as this cool, important, magically powered family, but I just feel that from a plot perspective, they're doomed to fail. They're doomed to fall to Euron. So I will see.
Kind of a bit like maybe the Arryns, that it's just been their power has been held back and held back, and then when they ultimately enter the game, they'll just get wiped out pretty quickly.
That sounds
yeah.
But his kids have some cool nicknames anyway. He's got Baelor Brightsmile and Garth Greysteel. But again, maybe just destined to fail.
So I think of the High Towers like, and I know that it's very, the similarity is there when you look at the High Tower with the flame above that never goes out, right? I know that's meant to be some sort of harbor reference, but I think of the Eye of Sauron from Lord of the Rings, where, you know, he's up there seeing things and knowing things, and maybe Lord Layton or whoever the guy up there is consulting spells. I almost want to believe that he may be pulling some strings throughout the book, like where you see these weird occurrences with dreams or maybe visions. And so I want to believe that it is the Mad Maid and the Lord of Hightower up there that are manipulating things, you know? That'd be cool because so far they've done nothing, and maybe they've been doing things that we just don't know, and we'll get that reveal. I don't know.
Could be. Could be like Duran, though. A bit disappointing in the end with your grand schemes.
Yes.
I feel like one of them has to succeed, though. Like, we can't have all, you know, all three with Old Town, Dorne, and the Eyrie, like, all have been holding back only to fail in the end. Like, you know, one of those things has to succeed. They can't all be conveniently wiped out by antagonistic forces.
Yeah, that's major blue balls.
Well, maybe their failure will have consequence, you know? Like if Doran meets up with Fagon, is what I'm hearing you guys call him, the fake dragon, and, you know, then that becomes their fate. If they fail, then that takes them out of the game, but maybe they do some damage to King's Landing or shift things, you know? Same thing with the High Towers. Maybe they do fail, but it makes me wonder why Euron is going there. I mean, it sounds like he's heading there because his Ironborn say they want to go there, but why go there? Euron seems to know what's going on in this world, and so maybe the High Towers have an important role to play, and that's why he's heading there. We'll get to see it from Sam's point of view.
Yeah, and those are kind of the three things there, where number one, you know, Old Town is in the way, and so Euron, in order to begin his conquest, needs to fight both the High Towers, and then number two, the Red Wine Fleet. Those are kind of the two major military forces and naval forces that are in his way before he can continue his conquest and attack King's Landing. And then it's just the third possibility of there being something of importance in Old Town that Euron wants specifically for his personal goals.
And these goals, what are these goals, I wonder? Because I have
to become a god.
Yeah, about to say that may be something that I mean, it's stuff we've certainly brought up on previous casts and maybe should be saved if we want to do more of a deep dive later into that preview chapter.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, because I think we'd have to, well, I'd certainly like to reread it first as well.
Yeah.
Right, and it's only, I mean, we don't have a full, it's only like a a summary of the reading that he did at one of the cons, right? Like, we don't have that in printed form.
Well, that was kind of my deadpan point, but,
yes.
But maybe my British deadpan doesn't carry over
the guy.
It was just right. Twitter,
My treatment of the preview chapters is I only ever read them once, and I haven't read them since.
Do you think when we finally see Leighton Hightower, there'll be some like Théoden parallels? Like he'll just be this madman with long hair and long nails, almost like an heiress type guy who has just locked himself away and hidden away in this tower?
Possibly. How many years did they say he's been locked up there? Like 15 years or something?
I'd say at least a decade.
That's a long time. You can't be up there just chilling. You need to be either into some really crazy magic or learning so much about the world that you didn't come down, even for all the things that have happened. You know, a lot has happened in 15 years. When did Robert rebel? It's not that long, I know, but like there've been five kings since you went up in that tower. I would say come down at least once, you know?
Maybe he just doesn't like stairs.
Maybe he's agoraphobic.
I could be it, indeed.
Maybe he's Batman. I feel we're running out of stuff to say that's sensible at this point when I go to that place.
Yeah. No, I was right about to say this is probably a good ending point here.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. Thanks for joining me. I'm glad we got enough people to actually do this. This was certainly some fun discussions. A good chunk of time with these three parts. I'm glad that we gave Feast its proper due here, you know, whether for good or for bad. So thanks everyone for joining me on these three parts. Like, always good to speak with you.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, man. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks, man. That was good.
That was very good.
Yay. Yeah, I'm really glad we did a Feast wrap-up. Like, yeah, it deserved one.
Absolutely.
I agree. I think it would have been enabling those who think Feast is a lesser book not to have one. So I'm glad it worked out. Thank you very much, Matt, and all of you for making it happen.
Yes, thank you, guys. Thank you very much for doing this. Indeed.